Hello and welcome to Edrei Live Apologetica podcast. I'm Edrei and my intention here is to defend the Christian faith from Brazil. Today we have the honor to receive here from Canada, Dr. David Fox. Welcome, Dr. Fox.
My pleasure. It's good to be here.
I want to start by asking you to tell our audience a little bit about yourself. Who is David Fox?
Okay. Well, I am an archaeologist, an Egyptologist, a Old Testament scholar. I have 5 degrees, and my PhD is in Egyptology from the University of Liverpool. I'm currently a research associate at the Vancouver School of Theology, and I have recently published a book called The Ark of the Covenant in its Egyptian Context, an Illustrated Journey, which was with Tyndale House Publishers.
Let me start by talking about what popularizers here in Brazil of ancient history have been saying about the Exodus and the formation of the nation of Israel, as the Bible tells. In 2019, a Brazilian magazine, Super Interessante, published a journalist article with the title "The Real Story Behind the Exodus," a história real por trás do êxodo. According to the magazine, the mass departure of the Hebrews from Egypt to Canaan was nothing more than a nationalist myth, okay? Well, what can we say about these theories that discredit the biblical narrative of the Exodus?
Well, you know, those sort of ideas that the Exodus was a myth basically comes out of what we would call in philosophy an absence of evidence argument. Essentially, we don't see any evidence, therefore such and such event didn't exist. The problem with those absence of evidence arguments is they are fundamentally flawed. They're what we call a universal negation fallacy. Basically, an ant gets on the top of his anthill and declares there's no Tokyo. Okay? How does the ant know there's no Tokyo? He's just going on an absence of evidence. In a similar way, people who argue that the Exodus is a myth are doing it from an absence of evidence position. Now, on the other hand, if we use the sort of evidence that ancient historians use, which tends to be indirect evidence, there's a lot of evidence for the Exodus. The problem is, though, that the issue has sometimes been muddied by, let's just say, crank theories and fringe theories, or say, less nuanced readings of the Exodus narrative.
Okay, so on your YouTube channel, you have divided your presentation of evidence in favor of Exodus in some parts, perhaps 90 parts, right?
Yeah, 9 parts of that series and still ongoing.
So
I haven't finished it. I've got more evidence. It's just
thanks God.
Have time.
It's good. Of course, it's impossible for you to literally sum up everything right now. But make the best of that. What evidence do you really have in favor of the Exodus?
Okay, well, the evidence breaks down into two categories, roughly, which is we have the internal evidence from the Bible itself, and then we got the external evidence. Okay, now the internal evidence is stuff such as place names that have a specific time and place, like, for example, the place names Peramzes, Pithom, Migdol, Pihahirot, Baal-Siphon. These are all towns that were either founded or are in occupation during the 19th dynasty, which is about 1300 BC. Okay, so that's the internal evidence. We also have other internal evidence, such as Egyptian customs that we find in the Pentateuch, such as the mummification of Jacob. We have customs such as carrying cylindrical objects like bread bowls in the shoulder garments. We've got birth bricks. These are all Egyptian customs. We also have been able to, say, locate from the internal evidence the land of Goshen, which is in the ancestral holdings of Ramses, the Ramesside clan, which happens to be around the city of Avaris, which is also right next door to the city of Ramses. Then we got the external evidence, and that comes down to the archaeological evidence. For example, the city of Avaris has been excavated by Manfred Bitok, and that is that was in the late Bronze Age the largest Semitic city west of the Orontes River. And it was a very big Semitic city. It had a temple of Baal. We find Semitic burials there. We find the material culture that's consistent with Semitic inhabitation, such as ceramic type typology. So we actually got a lot of good evidence that it was that the city was there. We also know from the archaeology that the city was abandoned during mid-Dynasty 19, which happens to be in the reign of Ramses II. So from the external evidence, we see this large population of people just pick up and leave a city, just abandon the city entirely. So those are roughly the two categories. We have the internal evidence and the external evidence. We find Semites living in Egypt, and we find a lot of Egypt in the Pentateuch.
What can we say about characters, patriarchs like Jacob or Joseph, and even Moses and Pharaoh? Do we have any evidence that they really exist?
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely. We don't have much for Abraham. We do have the War of Kings, and there does seem to be a correlation between Abraham's War of Kings with Amraphel of Shinar, and that correlation seems to be Hammurabi. And you can do that from linguistic evidence. And we can, and there's an Elamite king too that also is very, very close to in name to the one mentioned in like Genesis. The only problem with that is that there's three kings that are named almost the same at that period of time. So we don't know exactly which Elamite king it was, but three kings all overlap with the reign of Hammurabi at the same time. Okay, so that's indirect evidence for the existence of Abraham. Now, Abraham's father, Terah, we actually have written records of. He is mentioned in the Mari letters as being Terah of Urkesh. And Ur of the Chaldees seems to be a corruption of Terah of Urkesh. So Urkesh the Hebrew of Ur of Chaldees is Ur-Kashdim. So it's almost like a meme was stuck on the end of that. Just what we call in Semitics, memation. And then once the memation was done, later Masoretes broke the one word Ur-Kesh into two, Ur-Kashdim. But we have several letters of Terah, from Terah, that was written to the king of Mari. And he tells the king of Mari that, hey, you know, my son, you know, I've got this people here that, you know, I want to side with you, but the Elamites want to take over the city. So I'm hightailing it out of the city. My son is dead. And he moves to Haran. He becomes a sojourner. And he says, now I'm to the king of Mari, I'm now a Hapiru. So we actually got very good evidence for Terah, Abraham's father. Now, Jacob, We don't have any direct evidence other than the fact that Jacob was an extant name going all the way back to at least the second intermediate period. So we got lots of evidence that the name Jacob was very, very common. And it was a theophoric name, something usually like Jacob El, you know, God is my help. Okay. But it's also one of those words that's a kind of a bit of a pun too. It can also mean to grasp or seize, which is where we get the name a heel catcher. Okay. So it's one of those like punny sort of names. In the case of Joseph, we don't have any direct evidence. Unfortunately, the records from Avaris that would have named the vizier didn't survive. Okay. So, but presumably Joseph would have been vizier at Avaris over the Hyksos dynasty. But the records we have from the Hyksos period are very, very fragmentary. They're fragmentary at best. So unfortunately, we don't have any evidence, direct evidence for Joseph. We also don't have any direct evidence for, say, Moses, as much as we would love to, unless you include the writings of the Exodus itself. Okay. But the name Moses is consistent with Egyptian type names. Either, and there's been two theories proposed for the derivation of the name Joseph. One is Moshe, Mesis, from the Egyptian to be born, or Emshe, which is from the water. I tend to lean towards that latter theory myself, but they're both two theories that show the viability of Moses as an Egyptian name. So, and this we find many Egyptian names in, say, the Pentateuch. You know, Potiphar comes from the Egyptian word words padi rei, the given one of Rei. And Rei was the sun god, the Egyptian sun god. We find the name Hur. Hur is from the Egyptian Hor or Horus. So we find several Egyptian names in the Pentateuch. So there is some good evidence for the patriarchs and some of these people, but by no means complete.
Thank you for that. In that journalist article that I mentioned a few seconds ago, the journalist says that there was not Egyptian names in Pentateuch.
Nonsense.
But just Moses and Aram, maybe. I don't remember exactly now.
Yeah, there is lots of Egyptian names in there. And there's lots of Egyptian words. We find the word Egyptian word for linen there. It's the word sesh. The word for turquoise, mafkat, is in the Pentateuch. You know, so there's actually a lot of excellent examples of Egyptian vocabulary in the Pentateuch that we don't find in later Hebrew writings. A excellent study was done of this just recently by Benjamin Noonan, and he goes through all the Egyptian vocabulary. Now, he doesn't go through the names, but he goes through the vocabulary. And the vocabulary has made a very compelling case that the Pentateuch, at least the source documents for the Pentateuch, date to the late Bronze Age, based upon the dating of the vocabulary, the Egyptian vocabulary, that we find in the Pentateuch. Also, we should, if this had been written at a later date, we should expect to find more, say, Persian words, old Persian words, like we do in, say, like Esther. Esther and Ezra and Nehemiah have Persian words in them. So we should expect much more old Persian than we do find in the Pentateuch. In fact, we find no old Persian in the Pentateuch. But we do find a lot of Egyptian words. So this tells us at least that the source documents for the Pentateuch date to the late Bronze Age.
Yeah, you have a video on your channel very interested about the authorship of Moses on Pentateuch. Do you talk about this issue, please?
Yeah. Well, the thing is that what we see in, say, the Pentateuch is that they seem to have details, cultural details that would have only been known by somebody who lived in Egypt at that particular time. Theologians call this the Sitzen Leben. It's a German term, the situation in life. And what it is, you're taking the text documents and you're comparing it to the culture and see, well, what's the best fit here? In the case of, say, the Exodus narrative, we find that, you know, the king was really, really close to the Israelites. He lived nearby. Because what we had was Moses traveling from, like, the elders of Israel, talking to the king, going back, and this is back and forth going on. And in the night of the Passover, what happens is that, you know, at midnight, all the firstborn are dead. That same night, Pharaoh sends a message to Moses saying, get out of town. Don't want you here. And that message arrives exactly before dawn of the night of the Passover. So we know that from, say, the situation in Egypt, we know all where the capital cities were, so we know where the king was. And we've got a good idea where many of the Semitic settlements were. And there just happens to be one that's really, really close. You know, the imperial city of Peramses was 2 kilometers away from the Semitic city of Avaris. So that relationship, that closeness, what we call propinquity, that closest, like, it's like being on you have to have all your actors on the same stage. Okay. In order for you to have all your actors on the same stage, they have to be close by. They have to be, you know, waiting in the dressing room or off stage. They can't be out like 1,000 miles away and then make it to it. So all your actors here have to have a relationship that they can actually meet and discuss, and there's an interlocutor. So the Exodus, the documents of the Exodus really capture what it was like at that specific point in time. And we have details from the Exodus, from the Pentateuch, that would have only been known to somebody living in Egypt at that particular time. So it's very clear, like, for example, the route of the Exodus would not have been known to somebody after, say, the 10th century BC, because some of those cities no longer existed. Peramses did not exist after about 1080. So it ceased being a capital city or any sort of city at all. It was completely abandoned because of the movement of the river. The stones were cleared off and moved to Tanis. So that knowledge falls out of history very, very fast. And the reason it falls out of history so quickly is because it's replaced by a new capital. And that new capital takes prominence. And that new capital is Tanis in the Bible, which is called Zoan. So we have, for example, in, I think it's the Psalms, where it talks about the Israelites leaving Zoan, which was the closest surviving city at that point in time. So we do see texts being updated over time as they're being written, you know, notions being updated over time. But in the case of, say, the Pentateuch, we do have that sort of snapshot of history. Like, for example, when the Pentateuch was written, it had to be after the reign of Thutmose III, because we see the word Pharaoh. The word Pharaoh is a word that comes into Egyptian only in the reign of Thutmose III and beyond. Likewise, it seems to have been after the, it couldn't be any later than, say, Merneptah's reign, at least the source documents. Now, what we do seem to see in the Pentateuch is source documents that are sort of stitched together. We see this as we read, like, for example, Numbers or Deuteronomy, where it says that the Lord, you know, you get this caption at the beginning, the Lord spoke to Moses saying, and then you'll get a whole chapter. So what it looks like has happened in, say, the Pentateuch is Moses wrote the, basically in sort of a daylog format. You know, he's writing this one page at a time. He's got 40 years. He can do this. You know, 40 years in the you can accomplish a lot if you've got a lot of parchment and time on your hands. And this is what people did back then. You know, they would you know, do their movements in the day, their herding, etc. And then at night, they would then write. So when the Israelites come into the promised land, it's probable that Joshua or one of his successors had this stack of documents from Moses that they just more or less sort of stitched together to form the Pentateuch. But all the source documents seem to originate from, at least the vast majority of them, seem to originate from the late Bronze Age, at least given the vocabulary that we have.
So, taking defense this topic about the right process and mm-hmm. the formation of the books of canon of the Old Testament, specifically in relation to Pentateuch and Torah. Mm-hmm. Well, Pentateuch and Torah is the same thing. I'm sorry. But how these things influence your view about the inspiration of the Old Testament scriptures, the divine inspiration of the Bible, like this? Do you understand I think you're asking
how does the formation of the Old Testament canon influence our view of inspiration? Is that the question?
Yes,
for okay. sure. Okay, if that's the question, it is very much that when the Israelites entered the promised land, they were told to teach the Torah. Now, the Israelites were notoriously bad at this. They were terrible at this. We do know that when the Israelites entered the promised land, that they were nothing but worthless Baal-worshipping idolaters. Okay? The whole sort of Book of Kings and is basically prophets warning the Israelites, abandon your idols, get rid of your idols. It's constantly over and over again, get rid of your idols, get rid of your idols. Stop worshipping those pagan foreign gods. Stop it. So while it does seem to be extant, it doesn't seem to have been listened to. But we do seem to know that at least the notion of an exodus was there. You know, even for example, the documentary hypothesis likes to say prophets before Pentateuch. You know, the documentary hypothesis wants to say that the prophets were written before the Pentateuch. Well, then you then have to account for the fact that, you know, the prophets are saying, well, when the Lord brought you out of the land of Egypt, you know, even the documentary hypothesis theory, you know, has to recognize that in the prophets, they're making a reference to an Exodus event. That's going to be awfully difficult to do without a Pentateuch. It's going to be awfully difficult to do. I mean, you can appeal to cultural memory, but there's limits to that. And you start taking on this cognitive load of skepticism that just sort of, you know, becomes impossible to maintain. So, you know, that's sort of the conundrum of skepticism, is that you have to keep adding on these ad hoc theories to make it all work. Now, the whole idea of canonicity, you know, that's going to bring us back to Ezra and Nehemiah, where they sort of formalize canon at that point. And canon is somewhat misunderstood because people think that, well, you know, canon is something that is, you know, pronounced by a prophet or a pope or a council or something. That's not the way canonicity works. And that's not
very
how
inspiration. Good point. Very good point. Thank
that's
you
not how
that.
Canonicity works. Canonicity is recognizing what is already recognized as canon. So you get to the council of Ezra and Nehemiah, and they're basically saying, well, we automatically recognize, say, the Pentateuch. That went without saying. But they're also going to, at that point, recognize also, you know, their official history, the Book of Kings and Chronicles. They already recognize the prophets, the older prophets, the major prophets, Ezekiel and Isaiah. Then they're going to have to say, okay, now what are the rules going forward for recognizing canonicity? And this is where you have to, where, say, later prophets, like Micah, are going to have to deposit a copy with the temple, and it's going to have to, their prophecies are going to have to come to pass. So at that point, they formalize the process of canonicity. But canonicity is really only recognizing what is already recognized as inspired text. Now, when it comes to inspired texts, that is really that's an interesting sort of issue in and of itself, because the whole idea of inspiration is that it is God inspired, that that God intended his message to be communicated through the life and the preparation and ultimately the words of the person doing the writing. So it's kind of a weak thing to say, to be honest, but at the same time too, inspiration is what God does as much as it is the text itself. Because what God is doing is he's basically taking a prophet and governing his life. Okay. He's every experience that prophet has, or writer has, all the books he reads, all the conversations he has, the work he's done, all of that leads up to the point when he puts his pen to the parchment. And it's that process of guidance that's inspiration.
Okay, back into the topic about evidence for Exodus. Mm-hmm. One thing that many skeptics also attacks is the stay, the sojourn, the mm-hmm. Hebrew sojourn in Egypt. Was there really a great nation that Pharaoh oppressed and released from slavery?
Okay, we do know that the population of Avaris was enslaved around 1530 BC. Okay, we find that recorded in the biography of General Ochmoses, son of Abana. Okay, so we know the city was a slave at that point. It was treated when King Ochmoses I, not to be confused with General Ochmoses, but when King Ochmoses conquered the city, he treated it like a foreign city. And when treating it like a foreign city, it's customary to enslave the population. So That's what the king of the first king of the 18th dynasty did. He enslaved the population. At that point, they were mostly slaves owned by the government, the king himself. Okay, so we do know that city was enslaved. As far as the size of that city, estimates are around, at least by Montford Beetock, by are between 10 and 50,000. The area, however, based upon demographics of other Semitic cities, could put that city as high as 200,000. However, we most scholars today will think that the exodus was around 50,000 people. I tend to believe, think it's a little higher. I think it's in the hundreds of thousands myself, because they're also collecting people from, some from Pi-Ramses, some from Pithom, and through the Wadi Tum a lot where they exited. Okay. So I think tend to be a little higher, but even my estimates are, say, below the millions of people that used to be conjectured. Now, we do know a few things about that number in the Book of Exodus of 600,000. First thing we know is that the word thousand, LF, modern scholarship has now recognized that that word doesn't just mean a thousand. It can mean clan. It can mean army. It could mean just a group of people of an indeterminate size. So it's really seems to be much more account of, say, families or clans than it does seem to be a count of people. And even if it was, say, an absolute number, and which I sort of doubt, we have a lot of historical records that exaggerate numbers. This seems to be very, very common in ancient documents. Like, for example, the Battle of Thermopylae, where 300 Spartans are battling 2 million Persians. Well, they were battling 2 million Persians. The Persians could not maintain an army of that size. So we do know that ancient documents exaggerate numbers of people. But in the case of the Pentateuch, I don't think they're actually tabulating numbers of people. I think they're talking about particular clans, the number of clans. So 600 clans as opposed to 600,000 fighting men.
Okay, so what we can say about the Book of Numbers, that is mm-hmm. a list of people that stayed in Sahara Desert.
Well, one of the things we should recognize about the two censuses in the Book of Numbers is one at the beginning and one at the end. Okay, so there's two censuses, supposedly one at the beginning of the Exodus and one at the end, is that the numbers don't really change. The numbers don't change. Now, if we were talking about numbers of people, then we would have a demographic problem. Because one of the things about desert peoples is the number, if you are coming in from the outside and you're starting to adopt the desert lifestyle, you have a dramatic drop in population to adapt to the conditions of desert life. Now, actually, the Sinai wasn't really a desert at that time. It was a savanna, but still it's harsh conditions. But even in a savanna condition, you're going to get this where the population is going to diminish and not be replaced. So it would be very, very odd if the numbers of people at the beginning of the Book of Numbers remains the same as the end, if this was actually a wandering in the Sinai. But it makes total sense that if these were talking about clans, the numbers of clans might survive. It tells you that the family integrity has remained intact, even if the numbers diminish. We have to kind of remember that the Bible is much, much more focused on clans than it is on either individuals or families or even the tribes. Clans are everything in Israelite society. And we see this all throughout the Old Testament. So it's no surprise then that if the Book of Numbers is talking about clans in its first census and talking about clans in the second census, the point here is to actually show the sameness, that the clans have survived, that the family unit is intact. You know, this whole idea of the of preservation of the clans and integrity of the clans even goes into, say, the laws that they have to obey going into the promised land. When they get their inheritance, they are told, you know, don't move the stones that, that mark the land. Because that is, those parcels are part given to particular clans of people. Likewise, this is also why we have the levirate marriage in the Pentateuch, you know, where, you know, if the eldest brother dies and his wife hasn't had a child with him, that she's actually not compelled, but she should marry the younger brother and have two children, you know, one to replace him and one to replace in the second marriage. And that's all goes into clan integrity. That clan integrity was everything. It's how they kept their numbers up in a land where you're living on subsistence agriculture. You see, one of the reasons why the Canaanites lost to both the Israelites and the Philistines was they couldn't keep their numbers up. We see this in the Amarna letters, where these Canaanite cities in the Promised Land have diminished their numbers to where you really only have a couple hundred people occupying these cities because they were in a phase of depopulation. Because they weren't replenishing their numbers in the same way.
Now, talking about issue that you did a comment some minutes ago, about worship of Jehovah that the Hebrew people had. Some people say that the idea of a unique God came later and was heavily influenced by divine figures that other people had, such as El or Baal. What do you have to say about this issue?
Well, you know, the problem we have in this particular case is we have sort of an absence of evidence again. So I don't think that that the worship of, say, Jehovah is heavily influenced by, other Canaanite deities, although it does have its influences. We have to recognize that in the Pentateuch, worship of Yahweh is not being made directly from scratch. You know, there's Egyptian ritual practices in Israelite religion. You know, the whole priestly purification process is very, very similar to the Egyptian one. The only real difference here between the two is that the Israelites aren't shaving their heads and washing their mouth out with natron. It's the only difference between, say, the Egyptian priestly purification process and the Israelite priestly purification process. So there is some at least conceptual borrowing. You know, and when you look at, say, the laws in the Pentateuch, you know, they're confirming some practices of pagans and denying others. You know, they say, you know, you look at the Pentateuch and it's like, okay, you know, the Egyptians didn't eat pig. Don't eat pig when you go into the Promised Land. there's a pagan dietary practice that's confirmed in the Pentateuch. The Egyptians did circumcision. The Israelites are told, hey, continue circumcision because it was part of the covenant with Abraham. So, you know, not everything pagan is necessarily bad. But at the same time, too, there's some things that they say, you know, don't pick up the religious practices of the Egyptians. You know, there's some religious practices that you're not supposed to pick up. When you go into the land, don't pick up the pagan practices of the peoples of Canaan. So it's a mixed bag. There is going to be some influence there. Now, at the same time, too, we also have to recognize that Yahweh worship doesn't have, at least in its earliest phases, doesn't have hard boundaries. Okay. Many of those hard boundaries came out of 19th century religious studies. So when we talk about categories such as monotheism, henotheism, pantheism, these weren't categories that ancient peoples had. But they are a category, they are things that ancient peoples did. So for example, Akhenaten's worship of the sun god, Akhenaten, was a pantheism. It was a pantheism. The Hyksos worship at Baal, at Avaris, was a henotheism. You know, they believed in many gods, but you owed your allegiance to just one. So when the Israelites are coming out of Egypt, they're bringing with them this mix of pantheism, henotheism, and polytheism. And then they go to Sinai, and then they get the Ten Commandments. And they get a perspective of God that is now transcendent. And when you have a transcendent God in that sort of religious milieu, the whole system collapses into monotheism. Now, the reverse is also true. If you have an immanent God, your monotheism collapses into a monism or pantheism. So the opposite is true too. Your conception of the immanence or transcendence of God is going to affect what kind of God he is. So I am a little suspicious when I start hearing that, you know, the Israelites were originally polytheists. You know, Mark Smith made this argument that the Israelites were originally polytheists. But at the same time, too, Smith does not recognize that it's very difficult in ancient texts to distinguish between polytheism and monarchical monotheism. And monarchical monotheism says that there's one God, but there's also other angelic beings, like angels, seraphim, cherubim, what in ancient texts would be called lesser gods. Like, for example, you look at Egypt. Every spiritual being was called a god. They didn't make any distinction. They didn't have separate names for demons as such. So for in Egypt, there was big gods and little gods. So the ancient definition of what is a god is very blurred. It's very blurry. But then again, you get prophets like Isaiah saying that there is just one God, where you get declarations like in Isaiah 44, where it says, you know, or 43, where it says, I am the first, I am the last. Besides me, there is no God. You know, that didn't begin with Isaiah. Isaiah just stated it really clearly.
Okay. I'm sorry. I prioritized the Portuguese version of name Yahweh. I spoke Jehovah.
What? Why are you apologizing?
It's okay. Okay.
I mean, some people call him, look, there's actually nothing particularly, I mean, you can call the God of Israel Jehovah. That's the Latinization of the name. Nothing wrong with that. You can call him Yahweh. You know, there's nothing wrong with that. Some people are more reverent about it. But it's clear that ancient people called him Yahweh. Okay, that's what's clear. And the practice of calling him Adonai didn't occur until the 2nd century BC. That's when we start seeing the substitution of the vowels with a similar word, Adon, meaning Lord. This is why, for example, in our English translations, many of our English translations, the word Yahweh is replaced by small caps, Lord.
Yes,
it's because, people.
Too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's so as not to offend the reader of the translation. Now, later on, Jews, especially during the medieval period, are going to think that even Adonai is too irreverent. And at that point, they're going to just call him Hashem, the name. So yeah. That's a cultural thing. That's a cultural thing. And that's a cultural thing that's going to depend on your culture. But it's really, really clear that at least in early Israelite culture, they were calling God by the name Yahweh, which comes from an arcane Semitic form of the verb to be. Literally, he is.
Well, it's very
In Exodus, it talks about at the burning bush. You know, Moses, says, well, who are you? What is your name? What do I tell the Israelites?
I am that I
call
am.
You. I am that I am. Achye. That's that same verb. Achye. I am. And the third person of that, he is Yahweh. It's an arcane Semitic form of basically a second form of the verb to be.
It's very interesting. I don't know about these things. talking about names, curiously, my name is Edrei Lyle Yeshua. my dad really loved the Hebrew, so my name is like this. But Edrei is a version of the name of the city that Moses conquered. Mm-hmm. Later, Joshua continued this conquest in the Promised Land. Much of this is in the historical books. Is it possible to find reliability in these reports about the conquest of the Promised Land?
Oh, yeah. Okay. We have... here's the problem with the conquest is that one of the big misconceptions about it, and it's a big misconception, I have to correct this one all the time, is that the Israelites did not destroy every city they conquered. Okay? Destruction is not the point of the conquest. Occupation is the point of the conquest. The point of the conquest is that the Israelites are coming in, they're taking over these cities. They're occupying people's houses, eating people's food, using their plates and forks. They're using the fork didn't exist yet, but you get the point. They're coming in and they're using Canaanite stuff, eating Canaanite food, tending Canaanite vineyards. They don't want to come in and knock all these buildings down. They want to move in. The point of the conquest isn't destruction and pillaging. It's occupation. They're setting up home. Okay? So then, if that's the goal of the conquest, then we should expect to find that there should then be a continuity of the cities from, say, Canaanite occupation into Israelite occupation, which we do find. But we do find a change in, say, the diet. You know, prior to the conquest, prior to 1150, people are, eating pig. They're eating pig. But after 1150, we start seeing the faunal remains change from pig remains to, say, kosher diet, more lamb and goat. So we do find this evidence, especially in the occupation of the Judean foothills, that takes place, at the beginning of the Iron Age. Okay, so then, when we look at those cities that were, that the Bible says were explicitly destroyed with fire, we should then, in those particular cities, find a nice destruction there. Now, the Bible only has three of those, which are Jericho, Hazor, and Ai. Now, the last one, Ai, we don't know where that is. The fact is, it's a very hotly contested site as far as its identification goes. Some people believe it is Eight Tel, but that has problems with the stratigraphy that, you know, doesn't even make it consistent with, say, the Abrahamic narratives. So it's doubtful if that is really Ai, but it could be under certain archaeological circumstances. We just don't know. We don't know where Ai is. But the other two cities, Jericho and Hazor, have been identified. At Hazor, the stratigraphy is perfect. I mean, it's a great stratigraphy. Lots of ceramic remains. We find two destruction layers at Hazor, one that dates to the early Bronze Age and one that dates to the late Bronze, the transition between late Bronze 2B and Iron Age 1. That dates to about 1210, 1220 BC. So that's the time we would expect the Israelite conquest to take place. We also find at the destruction of Hazor some idols where the hands and heads of these idols were chopped off. Now, this would be very, very unusual if this was a Canaanite conquest. Canaanites don't destroy other people's idols. They take them home and they worship them. If this was an Egyptian conquest, well, they wouldn't be destroying their own idols. That wouldn't make any sense because many of these idols were actually Egyptian. So there are things here that wouldn't make sense if this had been a Canaanite or Egyptian conquest. The other matter is that the fact is that date is very easy to date because we find Cypriot ware there. And Cypriot ware is exceptionally easy to identify. It's easy to date. It was pottery that was imported from the island of Cyprus, very distinct. So we are dating for that destruction layer is pretty certain. It's pretty certain. Now, so that covers Hazor. Now, Jericho, we have a different case because what we have at Jericho is a city with bad stratigraphy. It's almost the opposite of Hazor. It's got bad stratigraphy. It has a lot of wind erosion. And there's complications at that particular site, but we still have some evidence here. It's got two destruction layers that are very important. We have a destruction layer that dates to the Middle Bronze City 4. Okay. And that seems to be too early for a conquest. Also, the walls aren't right. We know from the narrative of the conquest that these are casemate walls because Rahab the harlot is living inside the walls, literally in the wall. Middle Bronze fortifications, the glacis there is this big boulder-like structure that people don't live inside. But casemate walls are very interesting because you have two walls and you put fill inside. Well, people back then used to empty out the fill and make their homes inside the wall, inside the two walls. And that seems to be what Rahab the prophet has done, because she's able to lower the Israelites out of the window of her home. So she typically have to live inside the wall to do that. So this implies that this is not the Middle Bronze fortification. It's a later fortification. Now, some excavations have been done recently that the second destruction layer was actually identified by Garstang in the 1930s. And all he didn't, it was just a fragment of a destruction layer. And that fragment is in the late Bronze Age. But we don't know, we have not been able to identify if that late Bronze Age destruction layer dates to late Bronze 1 or 2, or basically 2A or 2B. Okay, We do know that the city, there was some sort of occupation there during the Late Bronze period. There's a Late Bronze cemetery nearby with a scarab from Amenhotep III, who's 18th dynasty. So that's definitely, that city was still in occupation in the 1350s, still being occupied in the 1350s. But we don't have a city there. And this was this huge mystery, is we don't find the rest of the destruction layer. We don't find any buildings. It seems to be completely blank slate during the Late Bronze Age. So this was a very, very perplexing thing for a long time. You know, how do we identify a Late Bronze city there when we got all this suggestive evidence for a city, but no actual city? Well, Lorenzo Nigro in 2020, who's been excavating at the site, published this very interesting paper where he actually found a surviving fragment of a Late Bronze wall, Late Bronze mud brick wall. And he says that we don't find any evidence of a destruction layer at Late Bronze 2A. That only leaves Late Bronze 2B. But he also says the problem with the Late Bronze 2B site is it appears to have undergone what's called site leveling. Basically, people in the Iron Age, Roman, and Byzantine periods scraped the site clean to rebuild on it. So Lorenzo Nigro has sort of solved the puzzle of when that destruction layer happened and what happened to the city afterwards. This also raises some very, very interesting possibilities for that maybe other sites in the Levant were also leveled. Because one of the interesting problems of archaeology in Canaan is that we find a lot of sites that don't have a Late Bronze occupation, even though it seems to be perfectly good area at the time for Late Bronze occupation. Like a tell that candidate for I doesn't have a Late Bronze occupation. Well, it might be because of site leveling there too. We don't know. However, what's interesting though, is now that we can pinpoint when Garstang's Late Bronze layer dates to, which is Late Bronze 2B, we can now say, okay, hey, look, we got a Late Bronze 2B layer at Jericho, and we now got a Late Bronze 2B layer at Hatzor. Match. That is the only candidate we have for the Israelite conquest, is in that period. And Hatzor and Jericho give us the evidence. Couple that with the transition of faunal remains, from say a non-kosher diet to a kosher diet that we find in the 1150s, with also the rise of Israelite ware. And we've got very, very good evidence. Then you also can couple this too with the altar that was found at Mount Ebal. You know, when the Israelites come into the land and after they conquer the cities of Ai and Jericho, they make an altar. They make an altar. They have one set of people in the valley against Mount Ebal. They have another one in the valley against Mount Gerizim. They put an altar on there and they create a cult site there that lasted for about 100 years. And that site has been positively identified as being in that transition from Late Bronze 2B to early Iron Age 1, essentially from 1200 to 1100 BC.
Hey, we have reached the end. Thank you very much, Dr. Falk. God bless you.
My pleasure. Very much appreciate being on your channel. And thank you very much.